To Michael and to Peter Cossey. I want to turn to the question of the wage growth and the absence of wage growth in the economy and the comparison between slow wages growth and political policy taxes. As we approach the federal election, the ACT campaign changed the rules of support heater, and so we could combat the ACT demonstrated the Bill of Rights campaign some time ago. Thank you.
I will say, though, is I think the government will be a very different prime minister to the style of an opposition in the years. I don't say this is an attack, but it's a political feeling because he knows how to keep himself to the moment. And he's adopted the Abbott approach in opposition to tear down Abbott first to the Turnbull and then to Morrison. But I think that he will then adopt a quite different style of government. That will be interesting, though, because it will see him clashing with new leaders, for example. I think he will become an intermediary between the people and business, the same way he was, quite frankly, as a union leader. At the moment, he looks much more hostile towards business, but I think that's because he's playing a role in the lead up to the election now. His biggest challenge, I would argue, will be the power to make that shift, having, you know, embedded himself the way that his politics used to be able to back them much more easily these days in modern media, social media, and all the rest of it. They get all much more to account in trying to do that. So his inclination will be to stick. I think that the public will give him the benefit of the doubt. His unpopularity fades as a relevancy factor once he becomes Prime Minister. Even Tony Abbott became popular for 5 years, but he became leader. So Australians give you the benefit of the doubt, but then it will be a challenge for him to replicate that intermediary role he plays between workers and bosses as a union leader, as Prime Minister. It will be tougher, but I think that will be his inclination because Bill Shorten's place in the board tends to him. He doesn't just want to be Prime Minister, he certainly wants to be Prime Minister, but he wants to be the first Prime Minister since Howard, not to be a joke of Prime Minister. Interestingly, possibly taken on by Abbott, he starts, if people assume he will be a joke in some respects, but I think he's very cognizant of wanting to be, you know, the first Prime Minister to like since Howard to actually win a real election, or even contest a real election. He's not just trying to get into office, and that's why he's tolerating all of these big policy scripts. That's why he's prepared to not ultimately fully cave on the asylum seeker issue. You know, he's, he doesn't want to just win. He wants to win that thing, be able to govern based on how he wants. And there is one challenge in that mix, of course, which is that he's hostile between unions and business. That's the one area where he has, if you like, been prepared to really carve out that role as an opposition leader where he will have to speak.
Yes, probably a question for Simon, but the neutrality of benefit that was spoken of, I think, is less achievable in the context of uncertainty that underlies much of the discussion this morning, which of course speaks to the complexity. In a historical basis, we used to be placed in reliance on august institutions such as the UN and NATO and all of that, and we're seeing a dilution of their influence across the global and other countries. I was just wishing to see how it might play out in the geopolitical and other contexts, with that, how relevant is that to today's discussion?
Thank you, it's absolutely relevant. It's like a long discussion. The thing about America First, like it's called, is that America has got a little MIA in the international core. In particular, and then not just with the establishment of the Bretton Woods institutions, where America is typically led. The one we should perhaps be the most concerned about is the WTO. And then there are some appointments coming up there that some say or may not make, and if you not make them or delay them, it really starts to gut that organisation. The flip side of that is that Trump says, well, who cares? That organisation is garbage anyway, and America First means America is big enough and bad enough to go toe-to-toe with China on trade or whatever. Now, when both sides of Australian politics say we believe in the rules of open national order, what we mean by that is, what? Well, we're the number 17 economy in the world or whatever we are. It's really, really good for the world's number 17 economy when the world's number 1, 2, or 3 economy find their hands voluntarily and contest each other in these institutions that the United States helped build up, World War II or so. One of the risks, and we were just talking about this at our table briefly before we came up, what does 8 years of clock look like for those in international institutions of continuing neglect from the American administration? What does that mean for a country like Australia, who hasn't got the throwaway necessarily, that the world's had a 1-2-3 economy to do? What does the world look like in the world's number 17 economy, where those institutions still relevant start to unravel? I think that's one of the big things about what's going on in China at the moment, that Trump not throws a strategic baby out with the tariff after, but the deal he sells for doesn't lose sight of the bigger game here. And Peter alluded to this, that we want China to come into the international system playing by quote unquote the rules that, you know, countries have been adhering to more or less, or at least the form of proximity about this World War II. And for me, that's one of the big crisis points that we're looking at internationally at the moment, with tremendous stakes for a game to come back in for an economy, for a country that decides to strike the damage being done to those institutions that have stayed as well for the most part.
One of those is that
tweaked by one of her members of parliament who put forward this government to say that the new government can be. So I think that that dynamic is interesting. We don't really know that voters are smarter than that. They decide to make some special teams. But I do think that there has been probably a risk this time of overlap. And it's interesting because the New South Wales Liberal government are very different in their political complexion to the Feds. I mean, just starting with energy policy to begin. But there are so many overlaps where the size of the problems of the broken combat way on everything from immigration policy to congestion and infrastructure. So I don't have a clear answer on what would happen or what the guides are perhaps in terms of the way that the vote might turn out. But I do think that the issues in New South Wales that dominate the election are those core issues which overlap with the Feds but won't be the core issues of the federal level. I think we'll get to that. Throwing that over the top layer that Australian politics and all of most other countries incredibly disciplined in voting patterns and stability locally, these are properly represent their area. That comes out as well. All of that's before we even get to the disaffected voter that comes from an ideological perspective, that breaks away from this tribalism of supporting the past just for the sake of it, just use it in some issue base now. And so they don't want to necessarily commit themselves to one side or the other. So you've got that on top of it as well. So all of these things come together to just make major money candidates to look fairly attractive. So voters are voting with their feet and going for local voting or whatever it might be. So two things that I have to go for my colleagues are because I have from Australia's in many ways, but one of the ways that it's a little special in the democratic world, special is this compulsory voting. It means that you are forced to buy the product on sale as a voter. You can't opt out of the marketplace, And so that means the political opportunity to say, I'm not on the above, and even most other political parties in the way they get with keeping the bastard votes. What does that mean? So there was a compulsory voting and there was a ready-made constituency for that at the polls in Australia. Number two, the method of election to Australia set up makes it quite, particularly in a double D, lowers the cost of entry, as it were, for those who are telephones, for those who are not going to be voting. That's the two final observations that it's empirical. If you take the ANC, God, like the ANC, they go to their competitor doing this analysis in the States. You go to the AEC website, they geocode every polling place, and it's a fun little afternoon of computing, but you can compute distance of each polling place from the GPO in each state, and you can compute in the Senate voting that polling place how many voters for a non-conventional candidate. That plot of voting for a either Labour, Lib, Nat, or Green, even called Green, a mainstream party this day, as a function of distance from the GPO. It just takes off once, and it's symbiotic of this sort of cosmopolitan versus the real ethos of the country that I once get, a 3-hour drive away from Bristol, as the real people are. It maps onto that very neatly, that these real salt of the earth, of the soil candidates have to be found in major metros. That's where you get the literary hat and the guy that you get a girl that's going to be using what. You follow that together and on compulsory voting and a low threshold for entry, you get this really interesting phenomenon in Australia where it has this very, very strong geographic
community. And Simon adds compulsory preferencing
yes,
level as well, and that's what, why someone like Tony Abbott is in such trouble, because 51% primary, if that gets to 45% primary, any other election that gets you over the line, you know, first past the post or whatever. But if you're voting against the company rather than for them on the compulsory voting and preferential voting that's compulsory as well, it's a trouble because there's 10% or 50% of people comfortable in that electorate that can vote against the primary voting or can be over 40.
Now, I think asking about the question, one of the things that we were debating before we had that was, is Trump going to be re-elected? Now, I'm going to ask this question, holding you to the standards of the economy. Their forecast, rather than political commentators, will always come up and say, you told me I got it wrong, the economy's never going to say that. So, tell fans, who do you think Trump's re-elected in the next election?
Look, thank you very much. Thank you, Melinda, and thank you to all of our speakers for their presentations earlier and their participation in this panel. I want you to join me in thanking our speakers and also all of those who have contributed to the 2019 CETA Economic and Political Overview. I commend it to you. Please do join me in thanking.